Dr. Mort's Tales of Terror by Mark J. Howard. Welcome once again, my friend, to the second collection of curated horrors picked from my vast library of terror tales. I'm Dr. Mort, retired neurosurgeon, and your guide to the unsettling underbelly of humanity's darkest corners. For years, I have traveled the world in search of stories so shocking they are only ever mentioned in hushed tones, where truth and fiction blend, distorting our perceptions of reality. In this collection, we are staying firmly within the confines of the British Isles for five very different slices of life and death. To begin with, let's take a look at Beatrice Blackwood, a mature, well-respected lady from the village of Hallow's End. Loved by generations of children, her eventual unmasking would send shockwaves of revulsion throughout the area in the unsettling tale of the Lollipop Lady.
In the quaint village of Hallow's End, children and parents alike knew and adored Mrs. Beatrice Blackwood, the Lollipop Lady. Her bright yellow vest and friendly smile were fixtures of the morning and afternoon school runs, ensuring that every child crossed the road safely. Her gentle voice and firm hand always there to guide the little ones. Yet, beneath the cheerful exterior, Beatrice harbored a dark secret. At night, she shed her benign persona and became someone else entirely. Britain's most prolific serial killer. She was a master of deception, her innocent guise hiding a chilling hobby that had spanned decades. Beatrice's first kill had been a mistake, or so she had told herself. 30 years ago, a drunk driver had nearly run over a child crossing the street. In a fit of rage, Beatrice had followed the driver home and in the heat of the moment ended his life with a swift blow to the head. The rush of power, the sense of control, had been intoxicating. It had awakened something within her, a dark craving that demanded to be satisfied. Her next victim was carefully chosen, a drifter who wouldn't be missed. The killing was methodical, planned. She lured him to her home under the pretense of charity, then dispatched him with a precision that surprised even her. Each subsequent murder became easier, the thrill greater. She perfected her methods, ensuring that no trace was left behind. By day, Beatrice maintained her role as the beloved Lollipop Lady, her interactions with the community flawless in the normalcy. No one suspected a thing. She attended church regularly, volunteered at local events, and was always the first to offer help to those in need. Her reputation as a pillar of the community was unassailable. Her garden, a vibrant oasis of flowers and greenery, held her darkest secret. Beneath the blooms and carefully tended soil lay the remains of her victims. Each new addition was marked by a new plant, a morbid tribute to her hidden hobby. She took great care in choosing the plants, selecting species that thrived in the conditions of her garden, much like her own dark nature thrived in the shadows of her double life. One crisp autumn morning, a newcomer arrived in Hallow's End. Detective Inspector Samuel Whittaker had been transferred from London, his reputation as a relentless investigator preceding him. He was the first to sense that something was off about the seemingly idyllic village. The unsolved disappearances of drifters and travellers, usually dismissed as unrelated, piqued his interest. Whittaker had a nose for patterns, and something about Hallow's End didn't sit right with him. Beatrice watched him with a wary eye, her instincts telling her that he was trouble. She continued her routine, all the while plotting how to deal with this new threat. She had never faced an adversary like Whittaker before, and the challenge both excited and terrified her. Whittaker's investigation led him to Beatrice's doorstep. He posed as a concerned parent, engaging her in conversation as she guided children across the road. She played her part perfectly, but Whittaker's questions grew more probing, his suspicions clear. One evening, as Beatrice tended to her garden, she felt the prickle of eyes on her. Whittaker stood at the gate, his expression unreadable. "Lovely garden you have here, Mrs. Blackwood," he said, stepping closer. "Mind if I take a look?" Beatrice's heart raced, but she smiled warmly. "Of course, Inspector, come in." As Whittaker admired the flowers, he subtly examined the soil, noting its unusual richness. "You must have a green thumb," he remarked. Beatrice laughed lightly.
"Just a lot of love and care, Inspector."
Whittaker's gaze hardened, and a bit of help from what lies beneath, perhaps. Beatrice froze. For the first time, she felt truly concerned. Whittaker's eyes bore into hers, and she knew the game was up.
"What do you want, Inspector?"
she asked, her voice cold. "To stop you," he replied simply. "You've been clever, Mrs. Blackwood, but not clever enough." That night, Beatrice made her move. She couldn't allow Whittaker to expose her. She waited until the village was asleep, then slipped out of her home, heading towards the detective's cottage. Her plan was meticulous, her resolve unwavering. But Whittaker was waiting for her. He had anticipated her move, set the trap, and now it was sprung. As Beatrice entered the cottage, the lights flickered on, revealing Whittaker and a team of officers. "It's over, Beatrice," Whittaker said, his voice calm. Beatrice didn't resist. She knew when she was beaten. As they led her away, she glanced back at her garden, her legacy of death hidden beneath the beauty of her flowers. She felt no remorse, only a cold satisfaction that she had outwitted them for so long. The village of Hallow's End was shocked to its core. The beloved lollipop lady, a serial killer, it was unthinkable. But the evidence was irrefutable. Beatrice Blackwood's reign of terror had come to an end, her secret hobby exposed to the world. In her cell, Beatrice felt a strange sense of peace. The game was over, but her story would live on. A chilling reminder that even the most innocent facade can hide the darkest of secrets. And somewhere in the village, beneath the vibrant blooms of her garden, her final victims rested. The last testament to the lollipop lady's deadly obsession.
Are you a nervous person? Perhaps a little skittish, living on the edge like a coiled spring, ready to burst forth with panic attacks and waves of anxiety? It's a fact that in my line of work, I meet many people of a nervous disposition, and if they weren't like that when we first meet, I soon change things for them. I once met a chap who was scared of his own shadow, albeit with very good reason, as we'll now discover in The Haunting Shadow.
I first noticed it on a rainy Tuesday evening, the kind of night when the rain drums relentlessly against the window panes, as the shadows in your home seemed to creep just a bit closer. I was alone, reading in my study, when a flicker in the corner of my eye drew my attention. It was nothing more than simply a dark patch, a trick of the light, I told myself, but something about it made my skin crawl. The days that followed were uneventful, save for the nagging feeling of being watched. It was a subtle at first, a chill down my spine, the sensation of eyes on the back of my neck. I brushed it off as sheer paranoia, an overactive imagination spurred by late nights and dark fiction. But the shadow was persistent. One night, as I lay in bed, the room cloaked in darkness. I saw it clearly for the first time, a mass of black, darker than the surrounding night, standing in the corner of my bedroom. My heart pounded as I stared at it, unable to move or look away. It was as if the shadow was a living entity, an embodiment of malevolence. I could feel its hatred, its desire to harm me. I didn't sleep that night, or the next. Exhaustion became my constant companion, yet fear kept me alert. During the day, the shadow seemed to retreat, hiding within the depths of the house. But at night, it was there, always there, watching, waiting. I began to dread the setting sun, knowing it would bring the shadow with it. Desperation drove me to research. I combed through books, websites, and forums, searching for any clue as to what was haunting me. I found stories, accounts of others who had encountered similar entities, shadows that had stalked and tormented, feeding on fear. None of the stories ended well. One particular harrowing night, the shadow grew bolder. I had taken to keeping every light in the house on, hoping to banish it with brightness. But as I sat in my brightly lit living room, it appeared in the doorway, a silhouette against the light. It moved towards me, slowly, deliberately. I backed away, heart racing, but there was nowhere to go. The shadow followed, relentless, until it was just inches from me. I felt a coldness seep into my bones, a paralyzing fear that rooted me to the spot. It whispered my name, a soft, sinister sound that filled my mind. I could feel it probing, searching for my deepest fears, my darkest secrets. I closed my eyes, willing it just to go away, but the presence only grew stronger and more oppressive. When I opened my eyes, it was gone. But I knew it was not truly gone. It had merely retreated, waiting for another opportunity to strike. I was left trembling, a broken man on the verge of madness. Sleep was a distant memory, my waking hours consumed by the shadow's presence. I tried to flee, to escape the shadow's reach. I packed a bag and drove, not caring where I went as long as it was far, far away. But the shadow followed. It was with me in the car, a dark form in the rear view mirror. It was in every hotel room, every deserted roadside. There was no escape. My life became a living nightmare. Friends and family noticed my descent into madness. But I couldn't tell them the truth. They wouldn't believe me. And even if they did, how could they help? This was my burden to bear, my tormentor to face. One night, in a dilapidated motel on the edge of nowhere, I decided I couldn't run any longer. I sat in the dark, waiting for the shadow to come. It appeared, as it always did, a silent, menacing figure. But this time, I did not retreat. I stood my ground, facing it head on. "What do you want from me?" I demanded, my voice trembling. The shadow moved closer, enveloping me in its cold embrace. It whispered again, but this time I understood. It wanted my fear, my despair. It thrived on my terror, growing stronger with each encounter. And I had fed it extremely well. I realized then that I had one weapon left, my will. I forced myself to think of happy memories, moments of joy and love. I refused to give in to the fear. The shadow recoiled, its grip weakening. I continued to focus on the light in my life, pushing back against the darkness. It was a battle of wills, a struggle for my very soul. The shadow fought hard, but I fought harder. Slowly, painfully, the darkness began to retreat. I could feel its rage, its frustration. With a final desperate push, I expelled it from my mind, banishing it from my presence. The shadow was gone. The room was silent, save for my ragged breathing. I had won, but at a cost. The ordeal had left me scarred, but I was free. Free for now. As I sat here, recounting my story, I can't help but feel a lingering unease. Yes, the shadow may be gone, but I knew it could return. I live in the light, refusing to let the darkness take hold again, and I hope every night that the shadow stays banished. Shadows wait, and sometimes they come for us.
When did you last go to watch a film at the cinema? Not many around now, are there? They seem to be shutting faster than pubs. So, imagine the excitement when a formerly closed Art Deco Odeon cinema reopens in a small, deprived town. New life injected into a much-loved entertainment palace. That's a great feel-good scenario. Unfortunately, in this case, that's not how things are going to pan out, as we discover in The Devil's Cinema.
The marquee of the old Odeon cinema shone brightly against the night sky, its neon lights flickering in a manner that might have seemed ominous had the crowd not been so excited. The Odeon had long been an abandoned relic, a forgotten piece of the city's history until tonight. Tonight, the cinema had been resurrected for a special event, a screening of recently rediscovered lost silent films. Word of the event had spread like wildfire. Movie enthusiasts, historians, and curious locals gathered in droves, eager to witness these cinematic treasures. The lobby buzzed with excited chatter as patrons discussed the films, the titles whispered with a mix of reverence and anticipation. The Sinful Path, Whispers in the Dark, London After Midnight. The projectionist, a man known only as Mr. Black, observed the crowd from the window in his booth, high above the theatre, with slick black hair and eyes that seemed to hold ancient secrets. No one knew where he had come from or how he had acquired the lost films, but his charisma and mysterious air had captivated everyone. Little did they know, Mr. Black was not a man at all, but the devil himself. As the lights dimmed and the projector whirred to life, the audience fell silent, their eyes glued to the screen. The first film, The Sinful Path, began to play. The grainy black and white images danced across the screen, accompanied by an eerie, almost hypnotic score. The story unfolded in a haunting, dreamlike manner, pulling the viewers deeper into its dark narrative. In the projection booth, Mr. Black smiled to himself. The films were cursed, imbued with dark magic and malevolent intent. Each frame, each flicker of light and shadow was designed to ensnare the souls of those who watched. The devil's plan was simple. Lure the unsuspecting audience with the promise of rare lost art and steal their souls while they were entranced by the cursed images. As the sinful path reached its climax, the air in the theatre grew thick with an unnatural tension. The characters on screen seemed to stare directly into the eyes of the audience, their expressions twisting into grotesque masks of anguish and despair. Whispers began to fill the air, low and unintelligible, but unmistakably sinister. The audience shifted uneasily in their seats, some glancing around as if sensing a presence just beyond their sight. But no one could tear their gaze away from the screen. The whispers grew louder, more insistent, echoing through the theatre like a chorus of lost souls. The second film, Whispers in the Dark, began without a pause. Its images were even more disturbing, filled with shadowy figures and flickering lights that played tricks on the eyes. The whispers turned to murmurs. The sound now coming from the very walls of the theater. Panic started to bubble beneath the surface, but still, no one moved. The devil's spell was too strong. One by one, the audience members began to slump in their seats, their eyes glazed and lifeless. Their souls were being drained, siphoned away by the cursed films, and fed to the devil. Mr. Black watched with satisfaction as his plan unfolded perfectly. He could feel the surge of power as each soul was captured, adding to his already immense strength. The final film, London After Midnight, the most celebrated lost film of all time, began to play. By now, the theatre was filled with a palpable sense of dread. The images on the screen were chaotic, disjointed scenes of horror and madness. The murmurs had turned to screams. The sound of countless souls crying out in torment, but it was too late for the audience. They were trapped. Their fate sealed the moment they had set foot into the Odeon hours earlier. Suddenly, a young woman in the front row, Sarah, snapped out of her trance. She had been drawn to the event by her love of silent films, but a strong instinct for self-preservation broke through the devil's spell. She looked around in horror as the lifeless faces of those around her and realized the truth. She had to escape, to warn others of the devil's trap. With a surge of adrenaline, Sarah stumbled out of her seat and ran towards the exit. The cinema doors were locked, but she pounded on them desperately, screaming for help. Her cries echoed through the darkened cinema, drawing the attention of Mr. Black. The devil's eyes narrowed as he saw Sarah's attempt to escape. With a wave of his hand, the images on the screen shifted. Now focusing on her, the characters reached out from the screen, their shadowy hands stretching into the real world, grasping for her. But Sarah was determined. She grabbed a heavy chair and swung it at the doors, smashing the glass and creating a way out. She squeezed through the opening, cutting herself on the jagged edges, but ignoring the pain. As she fled into the night, she could hear the devil's enraged roar behind her. Sarah ran until she reached the nearest police station. Breathless and bleeding, she told her story to the incredulous officers. They followed her back to the Odeon, but by the time they arrived, the cinema was empty. The doors were open, the projector silent, and the cursed films nowhere to be found. The police dismissed Sarah's story as the ravings of a traumatized woman, but she knew the truth. The devil had been there, and he had claimed his victims. She could only hope that her escape had disrupted his plans, at least for a while. The Odeon remained closed after that night, a dark, silent monument to the horror that had unfolded within its walls. But Sarah knew that the devil would not give up so easily. The cursed films were still out there, waiting for their next audience. And somewhere in the shadows, Mr. Black was watching, waiting for his next opportunity to steal the souls of the unwary. And so, the legend of the devil's cinema was born, a cautionary tale whispered amongst moviegoers and film enthusiasts. A reminder that sometimes the price of curiosity is far greater than one can imagine.
We're staying in the Northwest for our next tale as we travel over to Blackpool, the once thriving seaside resort, now spiraling into decay and despair. As we meet Jack Mason, the last in a long line of puppeteers, who have entertained families for generations. With the crowds long gone, Jack faces an uncertain early retirement as The Last Puppeteer.
The sun was setting over the beach of Blackpool, casting a long shadows across the deserted promenade. Jack Mason stood on the damp sand, his puppet stage barely attracting a handful of spectators throughout the course of the full day. The times when crowds gathered to watch his shows were long gone, replaced by smartphone screens and virtual entertainments. Jack was the last in a long line of family puppeteers, a tradition stretching back many generations. The Mason family had once been renowned across the British Isles, their performances legendary. But times had changed in the 21st century. There was little room for old-fashioned puppet shows, and Jack had finally decided to give up the business. He packed up his stage and puppets, each movement filled with the weight of resignation. As he folded the curtains and placed the wooden figures in their box, he felt a pang of sorrow. This was his farewell to a dying art, his last bow as the final Mason puppeteer. Jack trudged back to his rented guesthouse lodgings, the wind biting at his face. He began packing his belongings, ready to leave Blackpool and his past behind him. As he folded clothes and gathered trinkets, his thoughts drifted back to his ancestors. They had faced wars, economic hardships, and social changes, yet they had persevered. But Jack knew he couldn't continue. He had no audience, no income, and no future in puppeteering. His melancholy was shattered by a loud knock at the door. Startled, Jack hesitated before crossing the room. He opened the door to find no one there, only a battered old suitcase resting on the threshold. Something about it seemed very familiar, sending a chill down his spine. Jack dragged the suitcase inside and placed it on the bed. His hands trembled as he unlatched the clasps and lifted the lid. Inside was an old ventriloquist puppet, its wooden face cracked and faded. Charlie, the puppet his grandfather had warned him about, the puppet that was pure evil. Jack stepped back. His heart pounding, Charlie's eyes slowly opened, and the puppet's head turned to face him.
"Hello, Jack,"
it said in a raspy voice.
"Miss me?"
Jack's blood ran cold. He remembered the stories his grandfather told him. Tales of Charlie's malevolent nature and the terrible events that had followed its performances. Charlie had disappeared decades ago, thought to be lost forever. Yet here it was, in his room, and speaking to him. Jack found his voice. How did he get here? Charlie's mouth moved, its voice smooth and sinister.
"I've always been with you, Jack. Your family tried to bury me, but I can't be here. I'm part of the Mason legacy, and now you're my puppeteer."
Jack shook his head. "No, I'm done with puppets. I'm leaving the business." Charlie's eyes gleamed with a dark light.
"You can't leave the business, Jack. Not yet. You and I have to put a show on. One last performance."
Jack's mind raced. He couldn't perform with Charlie. The puppet was pure evil, a source of chaos and misery. But he felt an invisible force compelling him, pulling him towards the stage one last time. That night, Jack set up his stage on the beach, the moon casting an eerie glow over the sand. The waves crashed against the shore, a fitting backdrop for the macabre performance to come. Jack placed Charlie on his knee, the puppet's eyes scanning the small crowd that had gathered out of curiosity. As Jack began to speak, Charlie took over, his voice commanding and hypnotic. The audience was entranced, unable to look away. Jack felt his control slipping, Charlie's influence growing stronger. He was merely a conduit for the puppet's dark will. The show twisted into a nightmare. Charlie's jokes turned cruel. His stories dark and twisted. The audience's laughter turned to screams as the puppet's malevolence seeped into their minds. Jack could feel Charlie feeding off their fear, growing more powerful with each moment. Jack knew he had to stop Charlie, but the puppet's grip on him was too strong. Summoning all his willpower, he fought against the compulsion, his voice breaking through the puppet's control. "Enough!" Charlie, Jack shouted, his voice echoing across the beach. The puppet turned its head slowly, its eyes narrowing.
"You can't stop me, Jack. I'm part of you. It's part of the family."
Jack's hand trembled as he reached the puppet, pulling it away from his knee. "No! This ends now!" With a surge of strength, Jack hurled Charlie into the ocean.
"No!"
The puppet's voice screamed in rage as the waves swallowed it, the waters bubbling and churning with a natural energy. Jack watched as Charlie disappeared beneath the surface, the dark presence finally vanquished. The crowd dispersed in stunned silence, the memory of the horror fading but not forgotten. Jack stood alone on the beach, the cold wind whipping around him. He felt a sense of relief and finality. Charlie was gone, and with it the darkness that had haunted his family. He knew his days as a puppeteer were truly over. It was time to start anew, to leave behind the legacy of fear and control. As he walked away from the beach, he felt a weight lift from his shoulders. The shadows receding as he stepped into the dawn of a new day. In the weeks that followed, Jack found a new purpose. He began teaching storytelling and theatre to children, using his skills to inspire rather than terrify. And as for Charlie, the puppet remained at the bottom of the sea, a relic of a dark past, its malevolent eyes forever closed.
Our final story in this collection takes us into the heart of suburbia, where one man's night terrors become very, very real as our friend Henry encounters unwelcome visitors from beyond our comprehension. In the short story, The Night Surgeons.
Henry awoke to an unusual stillness in his bedroom. The air felt heavy, laden with an unsettling static that prickled his skin. As his consciousness sharpened, he realized something was profoundly wrong. His limbs felt unnaturally light, almost as if they were not there at all. Panic surged through him, and he tried to sit up, but his body refused to respond. His heart pounded as he tilted his head forward, straining to see in the dim light. The sight that greeted him was the stuff of nightmares. His arms and legs were gone, ending in neatly bandaged stumps. His mind reeled, unable to process the horrifying reality before him. He tried to scream, but his voice came out as a choked whimper. Henry's gaze darted around the room, searching for any clue to what had happened. His bed was drenched in cold sweat, and the metallic tang of blood hung in the air. The room, usually a sanctuary, now felt like a sinister trap. He tried to recall the events of the previous night, but found only fragments of distorted memories, bright lights, a high-pitched humming, and the sensation of being lifted from his bed. Desperation clawed at him. He had to find help. He needed to escape this nightmare. With monumental effort, he rolled onto his side, feeling the searing pain where his limbs had once been. He tumbled off the bed, hitting the floor with a sickening thud. Tears streamed down his face as he dragged himself across the room, inch by agonizing inch, towards the door. The hallway outside his bedroom was shrouded in darkness. He struggled to move forward, his breath coming in ragged gasps. Every inch of his progress was a testament to his will to survive. He reached the staircase and paused, staring down at the seemingly unsurmountable descent. There was no choice. He had to try. Henry maneuvered himself to the edge of the top step and let gravity take over. His body tumbled down, striking each step with a brutal force that left him gasping in pain. When he finally reached the bottom, he lay there, dazed and bruised, staring up at the ceiling. The high-pitched humming returned, louder now, reverberating through his skull. Suddenly, the front door creaked open. A silhouette appeared, backlit by an eerie, otherworldly glow. The figure stepped inside, and as it moved closer, Henry saw its grotesque, elongated features, large, almond-shaped eyes and thin grey skin. The alien looked down at him, its expression unreadable. Henry's mind raced. He had to make it understand. He had to plead for his life. "Why?" he croaked, his voice barely more than a whisper. "Why are you doing this?" The alien tilted its head, its eyes reflecting a cold, clinical curiosity. It reached out with a spindly arm, a device clutched in its hand. Henry's vision blurred as the alien pressed the device to his forehead. His thoughts became muddled, and a wave of drowsiness washed over him. As he slipped into unconsciousness, fragments of the alien's intentions seeped into his mind. They were studying him, experimenting with the limits of human endurance and the capacity for pain. His removal of limbs was just the beginning of their twisted exploration. The realization was a chilling dagger to his soul. Henry awoke once more, back in his bed. The bandages on his stumps were fresh, the bloodstains cleaned away. Yet he knew now it was merely a facade. The aliens had not left. They were watching, waiting to continue the grotesque experiments. He lay there, helpless and horrified, knowing that every night he would face new horrors, new violations of his body and mind. The high-pitched humming began again, and as the familiar lights filled his room, Henry understood with bone-deep dread that there was no escape. The night surgeons had claimed him, and they would not release their grip until they had unraveled every secret of his humanity. And so, the nightmare began anew.
The poor man. A shocking situation, I'm sure you'll agree. And by all accounts, it happens more often than we might imagine. That'll give you nightmares, I'm sure. Thank you for listening to my second volume of Dr. Mort's Tales of Terror, and I do hope you'll stop by again for further twisted tales. Until next time, I'll wish you a very good evening. Sleep well, and don't let the creatures under the bed bite. Dr. Mort's Tales of Terror was presented by Tyler Gotch. The readers were Peter Slater and Simon Entwistle, recorded live at the Bunker Project, Manchester. Original music was written and performed by Nathan Connell Howard. Produced, written and directed by Mark J. Howard. Produced by Stephen Greenhalge. You've been listening to a Bunker Project Studios production for Northern Misfits Limited.